My wife and I have been married for 17 years, and one of the things that I've learned in the course of those years is that when I said I do, please understand me, I really didn't when I said I do. I didn't know what I was getting into, that was for sure. I had no idea what I was getting into saying I do, and I know my wife didn't either. Not only what has come, children and the life together, but also marriage itself. And I don't think anyone, unless they've gone around that the rose bush a couple times, really knows what they're getting into when they first say, I do. We're going to be talking about marriage here in the first hour of Issues, Etc. Now, we're going to be talking about it simply in terms of a healthy marriage, not in the way that people always talk about a healthy marriage. People think about love as a feeling. Love is not primarily a feeling. It's primarily a decision. And how does that change the way we think about marriage? Could the fact that love is often viewed as a feeling account for the abysmal failure of so many marriages nowadays? Here in the studio with us for this first hour of Issues, Etc. is a regular guest on the program, Jennifer Roback Morse. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institute and author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. We'll be talking to her in just a moment. In the next hour of the program, we'll spend 25 minutes with Lynn Fredrickson, talking about parental advice for the new school year. She's headmaster at Messiah Lutheran School in Kenosha, Wisconsin. She was a guest of ours recently to talk about confession and absolution. Just some basic good advice for parents facing a new school year. Our kids just started school, and it feels like I just started school. The whole schedule changes. A little later in the program, we'll also hear some audio from the famous atheist Michael Newdow. He, of course, brought the Pledge of Allegiance case asking that the rest of us accommodate his atheism by removing the words under God from the pledge. We're going to be talking about what drives Michael Newdow and hearing the latest in that case as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live, by the way. It's Tuesday, the 24th of August. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And everyone who calls in this first hour with Jennifer Roback Morse with a question or a comment on marriage will receive the new booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage, that Jennifer has recently authored. Jennifer has written this booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage. And welcome to Issues, Etc., Jennifer.
Thanks very much, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, what brings you here to the St. Louis area so that you can join us here in Studio A?
Well, I'm participating in a retreat over at the Our Lady of the Snows. I'm giving one of the speakers at a retreat for the Association of Consecrated Virgins, which is a group of women living in the world who have taken vows of virginity. And they asked me to come and talk to them about marriage, family life, human sexuality, and just the unique contribution that consecrated virginity and married life have to make to one another. It's a very interesting group.
Is this a religious order? Or
It's not a religious order, Todd. These are women living independently in the world. They're not part of any religious community, and each one is responsible to their own bishop of their own local diocese. So it's a very diverse and interesting group of women, I should say. I would never have imagined a group of ladies quite like this, but I've really had a nice time out there.
I also imagine that you never would have thought of yourself as, with the training that you have, of writing a book on marriage. How does an economist come to write a book about marriage?
Well, I ended up getting interested in marriage and family life because I had children. Having children changed my whole perspective on the economy and on political philosophy and many other things. And as I've told this story before on Issues, Etc., it was having two children within 6 months' time, one adopted and one by birth, that taught me that we really need to have strong families in order to have freedom in a society. And my book, Love and Economics, really explores the whole connection between love and the family and the perpetuation of a free society. So that's how I initially got into it. But in talking with you and other radio show hosts and with the callers who have called in, it has become clear to me that there are many, many people who desperately want their marriages to work, who just don't know how to do it, who don't know how to make it work, and who are desperate for information. And so that's how I ended up writing the small booklet, 101 Tips for a happier marriage, because it seemed to me that there was a great need for people to have some accurate and useful information.
Now, we talked about this before, but you also have a website that you recently launched.
That's right.
Join the Revolution.
Join the Marriage Revolution.
Join the Marriage Revolution.
Yes, the Marriage Revolution is one man, one woman for life. That's our idea of a marriage revolution. And I think you'll agree that if we could just put that into practice, we would really revolutionize society.
I cannot think of a more timely topic. I have just been very deep into writing a pamphlet on same-sex marriage. And I am continually returning to this theme as I write this thing. I told my producer, it's all I've been thinking about lately. This theme that the very foundation of human civilization is a man and a woman in marriage, and the family that results from that. It seems so common sense. Why is it today, Jennifer, that we actually have to argue for this, and that it seems like a revolutionary idea, as you say?
Well, you know, that's a darn good question, Pastor Todd, and all I can tell you is that we are, for reasons that are not known to us, we have been called to live in this particular time when marriage has been turned on its head and everything that used to be obvious has been turned upside down, and we now have to give an account of things that people used to take for granted. So that's our task. As any kind of Christian witness, that's what we have to do, is explain these basic things. But the fact is, if you look across the broad swath of human history, the idea of lifelong monogamy is a uniquely Christian idea. There has never been another civilization, there has never been another world religion, major world religion, that has demanded monogamy of its followers. Virtually every other religion you can name has either allowed polygamy, and sometimes allowed not only polygamy, but sometimes even concubinage, or sometimes serial polygamy, which is basically what we have in America today with a divorce and remarriage, more or less at will. That really amounts to serial polygamy. So the fact is that when Jesus said to people, one to a customer for life, that's a rough paraphrase of Matthew 19, when he said that, he was saying something revolutionary. And they knew it at the time, because he said, when they asked him, well, gosh, Moses said we could have divorces, he said it was only for the hardness of your hearts that he allowed you to have divorces. And from the beginning, it was not so. And he made it very clear that this is what he wanted from people. And he also, the context of the passage also makes it clear that lifelong monogamy was always a challenge. This is not something that just became difficult the day before yesterday. I mean, those guys in Moses' time thought it was too hard. And after Jesus got off this shot across the bow about, one to a customer for life, after he said that, the disciples kind of took him aside and said, yo, master, if that's the case, then it's not expedient to get married. And then he goes into his whole discussion about choosing virginity for the sake of the kingdom. It's really quite an interesting passage that our Lord puts forth there, but he makes it very clear that this was always a challenge to people, and that he meant it to be a challenge, but that it's a very important and central part of Christian civilization. We really have to defend it and explain it.
So there's a lot at stake. Also at stake, as it's not only part of the thesis of your book, Love and Economics, but also the thesis of your new pamphlet on marriage as well, that love is commonly viewed as an emotion, or a complex of emotions. You say, no, first and foremost, love is a decision. What do you mean by that? And why is that so important to understand?
Well, I say love is a decision because the feelings will never be enough to sustain you for a lifetime, because anybody who's married for any length of time knows that you're not always going to feel like doing what is good for the spouse, doing what is good for the marriage, for the good of the relationship. In fact, you're not always going to feel like doing what's good for your child, and that's the most instinctive form of love that we can know. You know, it's instinctive to want to take care of the baby, but there are lots of times that you just don't feel like doing it. It's a decision to get up in the middle of the night. It's a decision to do these things, and so therefore, it's very important to realize that when we say I love you, we're not saying, I like the way you make me feel right now. You see, that's what we think it is. That's what society has boiled it down to. I'm in love if I like the way you make me feel. But if I don't like the way you make me feel, then I don't love you anymore and I don't have to do anything anymore. That is a completely different picture of human love than what we have from the Gospels. And it's certainly a different picture of love than something that's going to sustain you for the lifetime. And that I think is the key thing. It won't sustain you for a lifetime to simply follow your feelings. You chase your feelings, you're really going to be led astray.
I've been fascinated watching television lately. And listening to the radio, seeing how many commercials there are now for dating services. It seems it's a new cottage industry, but it's more sophisticated now. Now we have the help of computers; we can match one another up. And very often, you'll hear that very definition of marriage you just mentioned, or love that you just mentioned. I like the way this person makes me feel about myself. That's not love.
That's not love. That's not love. That's using the other person as a commodity. See, the other person becomes something that's either a recreational good, something that is entertaining for you, or the person is a kind of a little drug, you know, something that gives you a buzz or a feeling that you enjoy. And, you know, if you think about that, the reason this doesn't work, Todd, is that nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that kind of relationship. If it's legitimate to say, I like the way you make me feel, then it's legitimate for me to use you. But the reciprocal has to be true too. Then it's legitimate for you to use me. And when it comes down to that, nobody wants to be on that end of the process. And that's why when you think about it, you start really thinking about it, you see, this can't work. This is not really a stable situation. Because as soon as somebody decides, gee, I don't like the way this feels, then the whole premise of the thing falls apart and no one can get the satisfaction that they're looking for. Neither side can.
So then let's push that, the next step, as you do in both of, especially in your work, Love and Economics. If love is considered an emotion that is basically self-serving, that will not sustain anything approaching a lifelong monogamous marriage. And if marriage is, as you assert, the foundation for civilization itself, what is the impact on society when this is what marriage becomes?
Yeah, well, what you're going to have are... you're going to have a lot of unhappiness. That's the short version. But let me spell out some of the forms of unhappiness that you're going to have. And some of these are in the pamphlet, too. First of all, the impact on children of divorce has been simply devastating. This is well documented by now. We've had 30 or 40 years of no-fault divorce, so-called no-fault divorce, and that has been devastating on children. Children of divorced parents are much more likely to drop out of school, have poor grades, have attendance problems, they're more likely to have poor health. Whole variety of problems that children of divorced parents have in comparison with children of married couple parents. And it's also, it turns out that divorce is very hard on the couple themselves. And this is what is, I think, the most paradoxical thing. The people think they're pursuing their happiness, but in fact, divorce increases the likelihood of suicide by something like 3 times. You know, divorced people are 3 times more likely to be committing suicide than non-divorced people. There's a tremendous amount of material wealth that's dissipated in a divorce. In other words, divorced couples don't accumulate as much wealth as lifelong married couples do. And that doesn't even count the fact that you're spending all kinds of money on the divorce settlement itself and so on. There's just a lot of dissipation of wealth that goes on. And so people think they're going to be better off, but in fact, they're wearying themselves in this pursuit of feeling good because they've misdefined and misunderstood what the marriage should be all about in the first place.
So it comes down to this, it sounds like. You would never think this, but our view of love, our popular view of love, not only has personal consequences for those involved in these kind of marriages, but it has economic and social consequences for the whole society.
Absolutely. And that was the thing that so stunned me after I had my kids and started to realize how much children actually need from parents. It just became clear to me that as a parent, I don't get to do any old thing I feel like doing. This is not an activity that's sort of like the decision of whether I'm going to put an addition on my house or something like that. This has big consequences to lots of other people. And the biggest and most devastating one, of course, is that if children do not have the secure bond between themselves and their parents. And if they don't see the secure bond between their parents, their children are much more likely to have difficulty with conscience development. And if you have kids who can't control themselves and who don't have a good conscience, then they are going to have they're going to impose a lot of costs on other people in the society, and that's going to end up having big social consequences, namely prisons and extra money spent on education and a whole lots of fiscal consequences, direct fiscal consequences that flow from problems in married life. So it's not just a private decision whether to get married and stay married. It turns out to have lots of social ramifications.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Moore. She is author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. She's also written this new booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. This is Issues Etc., and I'm Todd Wilkin. You can join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The best callers during this hour, or emailers, I'll give you that address in just a second, will receive a free booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage. This new booklet from Jennifer Roback Morse, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Jennifer, conscience, you just mentioned that, and I think the most recent conversation we had was on the formation of the conscience, if I'm not mistaken. I'm wondering about where we are today. It's one thing to speak about it theoretically, but given the state of marriage today, what do you expect from this generation of children, born of divorced parents, multiple marriages, shuttled back and forth, their time has been spent between two parents? What do you expect conscience-wise of them when they become adults? And many are telling us, by the way, that this generation, the millennials, represent a new baby boom. Perhaps 80 million, they'll exceed the previous baby boom, and that's going to have an economic and a social impact as well. What will be the state of their conscience in adulthood?
Well, I think we've got a mixed picture here. I think we undoubtedly have a large number of people whose instinct is to say, what's in it for me, about virtually every topic that they come to. What's in it for me? I need to get mine. And not really thinking about the consequences for others. There's undoubtedly a large percentage of people who are like that. But at the same time, Todd, one of the things that I have noticed is among that very generation, a hungering for lifelong marriage. Now, I'm not talking about kids born in 2000 because obviously they're too young. We haven't seen them yet. But college-age kids, kids that are in college and 20-somethings today, what I'm seeing is that these are people who have already been through divorce. They've been through their parents' divorces, sometimes more than one. And they really want marriage to last, but they're scared. They don't think they can do it. They don't know. And they have no clue how to do it. They don't know how to do it. And that's one of the reasons that I thought it was time to stop writing for academics, Todd, and start writing for normal people. And that's how I kind of distilled this little pamphlet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage, because it just seemed to me that people need some very nuts and bolts, practical things that they can use on a regular basis.
You write about that that generation that is desperate for marriage as the kind of pie in the sky, it's sad that it is, considered that now. They're desperate for it, but they don't know what to do to make it work, so they find themselves divorced. And you write that people often get divorced hoping that the next time around, they get divorced intending to remarry, hoping that the next time around it will work. Do the statistics regarding second marriages bear out that hope?
Now, as a matter of fact, second marriages are more likely to end in divorce than our first marriages. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. One is that people get jaded. They want it to work, but they don't know how to make it work. And they think, and the other thing that happens is that people think that it must have been the other person's fault. I have seen this many times, and I'll bet you have too, that sometimes when a person gets divorced, of course, the immediate thing is to be thinking about what could you have done different, what could the other person have done differently. But often what will happen is over time, people will settle into a position of, oh gosh, I did all that I could have done. I can't think of anything I could have done differently. And you start to rehearse that position in your mind of, it was not really my fault. I did all anybody could expect of me. And you sort of get solidified in the thought that you already did the best that you could do and that you're kind of a victim, you know, and you start to reinforce this picture of yourself as a victim. Now, if you take their kids aside and ask their kids, gee, is there anything your mom and dad could have done differently? They'll give you a whole laundry list of things that each one of them could have done differently. But the point is that each member of the couple is deluded about that. They don't want to see that they contributed to the breakup of the marriage. And as more time goes by, they get hardened in that position. Whereas if you stay married, one of the things that can happen if you really do your marriage right is that you can keep yourself open to hearing from your partner about what you did, what you're doing wrong, and you can grow up, and you can take that information in and be much less rigid about defending yourself all the time. And I think that's one of the biggest differences that I see in people who've been divorced for a long time, who will tell you things that their spouse did 20 years ago. And I'm thinking to myself, gee whiz, you know, let it go, give it a rest here, you know. And people don't realize how foolish they sound rehearsing something like that that took place 10, 15, 20 years ago.
But they rehearse it, it sounds like you're saying, because it's now become part of the warp and the woof of their personality.
I think that's right. I think there's a way that you're self-justifying what you did. Yeah, and of course, we all need to justify ourselves. We all need to feel good about ourselves. So, you know, we'll tell ourselves again and again that it was really okay what we did. It was really okay what happened. It wasn't really our fault. And of course, if it really is your fault, then you have to tell yourself that a lot in order to believe it. And you sort of get this more shrill voice going in your head that it wasn't really me. No, it wasn't my fault. And of course, that's very destructive. But if you're in a loving relationship with somebody who can gently, or maybe even not so gently, point out to you that, you know, look, you need to shape up here. And if you can receive that information without it being life-threatening to you somehow psychologically, you're just going to be way better off if you can do that.
With only 30 seconds before we need to go to a break, is the amicable divorce, the sitcom divorce that you see, they live down the street from each other. They're friends. They share the kids. They're remarried. They're happy with one another. They joke and banter about. Is that a myth?
Well, basically, it's a myth. I mean, you see elements of that, and I think many divorced couples have some elements of that. But there's also a kind of bitterness and pain in the kids that doesn't get shown on the sitcoms. The kids want their parents to be together, and they want their parents to love one another. So I think it is very misleading.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morse, author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. She's written this new booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Our call-in number, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The best callers will get a copy of that booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And as usual, when we talk about subjects like this, we encourage you, if you want to call in anonymously, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, 25 more minutes left with Jennifer Roback Morse. In the second hour of the program, Lynn Fredrickson joins us to talk about some parental advice for the new school year that's beginning. Then we'll be talking about St. Bartholomew, the church remembers. Well, you also know him as Nathaniel. The church remembers this disciple of Jesus. We'll be talking about that with Pastor Burnell Eckert in the second hour of Issues, Etc. When we come back, more on marriage with Jennifer Roback Morse. Stay with us.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When a Christian prays, what is he doing that's any different from a Muslim or a Jew or a Buddhist when he prays? When God answers Christian prayer, why does he answer? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August is all about Christian prayer. It's called, Is God Listening? It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Andrew Steinman. You can order Is God Listening by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section, and you'll find the book, Is God Listening, by Dr. Andrew Steinman. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August. Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
Music, outreach programs, and real-life examples of answered prayer help get kids interested in missions. This Global Minute gives you some tips and resources. A kids' choir out of Sanford, Florida, helps other children learn about serving Christ in their neighborhoods and around the globe. The Worldwide Kids Club takes a multifaceted approach in helping kids take their first steps into missions. Local projects and activities that families can do at home are listed on their website, along with examples of answered prayer. There was an incident in Haiti where one missionary boy was swimming and was almost struck by a boat. But at that moment, a friend of the family was at home praying, unaware of the immediate danger. Pray more kids will follow God's calling. Get your kids involved in missions using the website worldwidekidsclub.com. That's worldwidekidsclub.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. A lover might keep a rose in a book. I put postcards and pictures and notes into my books. The other day I was looking something up and came across a note from August 24th. I don't know what year. Probably the late 60s. The note was a list of the milk this college student had to deliver to the Ford stamping plant in Chicago Heights. On August 24th, long ago, I unloaded 106 cases of milk, each one taken off the truck by hand. No hydraulic lifts back then. Life is made up of piecework, of countless little cases we do day in and day out. Those are trusts to you from God. Jesus says in Luke 16, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. Our medium-minded society pays attention to the big things, the celebrity lives, the big stories, but God looks at our little piecework. Does he who formed the eye not see? Psalm 94, verse 9. A little irony, I found the list for the Ford plant in a Greek dictionary under the word anthropine. Anthropine means human. How appropriate. Human life under God is all about the little cases you and I lift every day.
Here's an opportunity that's sure to interest the kids. On Wednesday, September 1st, the Niña, a replica of Columbus's favorite ship, will dock in Alton. The ship will be docked at the Alton Marina until her departure early morning Tuesday, September 7th. Built completely by hand and without the use of power tools, Archaeology magazine called the ship the most historically correct Columbus replica ever built. While in port, the general public is invited to visit the ship for a walk-aboard self-guided tour every day of the week. That's in downtown Alton.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about marriage with Jennifer Roback Morse. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work, and she's also written a new booklet. We're giving it away to the best callers and emailers during this hour, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage. Now, you can purchase the booklet from Spence Publishing by going to their website. It's SpencePublishing.com or calling them toll free 1-888-SPENPUB 1-888-SPENPUB. Now, a listener called anonymously and had asked about a husband that is growing distant, a husband that seems to be distancing himself from her, the wife, and she wants to know what to do about this.
Now, can I talk to this caller, or we just screen him? Okay,
no.
Okay. Oftentimes it's best to not insist, to not push too hard, because a lot of times when a fellow is retreating from a relationship, unbeknownst to us women, We've been leaning on them pretty hard. A lot of times that's the case. Now, it's impossible for me to tell from a distance, obviously, but I think this is one thing to keep in mind, that what seems like enough distance to us may seem smothering to the other person. And so oftentimes it's a good idea to give them some space and to make yourself available. Say, you know, would you like to talk? Would you like to do something together? And not lean on them for intimate conversation. If they're resisting that, not insisting can sometimes be a helpful thing.
Now, with that said, could it also be a warning sign if one or the other partner, not necessarily just a husband, but the husband or the wife, seems to be intentionally putting distance between them and their spouse?
Oh, yes, it certainly can be a warning sign. And the issue is, what is it a warning sign about? Mm. What is it? How are you supposed to interpret that signal? Now, in the booklet, I talk about a number of different things that you can do to reduce conflict, to limit the number of quarrels you have, to recover better from the quarrels that you have. So each person's going to have to look into their own situation to see what might be sources of tension that might be driving the other person away. So it's impossible to diagnose over the phone like this, of course, but it certainly could be a warning sign. Now, one of the reasons I wrote this booklet the way that I did, the subtitle of the booklet is "You Can Improve Your Marriage Even If Your Spouse Doesn't Change a Bit." And I think that's an important point for each person to see, that there's something they can do that's constructive, even if the other person is kind of hanging out there and kind of tired of the whole thing and is not really willing to change very much. A lot of times traditional marriage counseling doesn't work very well because each partner views the counseling situation as a place where they're going to try to bully the other person into changing, you see. And nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that. And so a lot of times that won't work. But if you start with yourself and say, well, look, what could I do that's constructive? What could I do that's more loving? Then you have a chance of actually making some progress. And that's why I wrote the booklet in the form that I did.
So in other words, when most people go to marriage counseling, they go thinking they're taking the other person to the therapist.
A lot of times, I don't want to say most, but a lot of times that's the case. Yes, I think that's true.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We will talk with this caller from Florissant. John is on the line. John, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, thank you. I was married for 17 years, and then I was divorced for a couple years, and then I've been in about an eight-year relationship, and it's been a monogamous and celibate. And we're very good friends, and in a lot of ways, we never argue or anything like that. But I'm still gun shy, going back into another marriage relationship. And she's putting no pressure on me, and obviously I'm not in very much of a hurry. And I was wanting to know what your short version of what really is a compatible, loving relationship.
John, thank you.
Thank you, John. Yes, when you say it's a monogamous celibate relationship, you mean both words of that? You're exclusively seeing this person, and it's a non-sexual relationship. Is that what you're telling us?
That's correct.
Well, that's very beautiful. That sounds like friendship to me.
It's very rare nowadays.
Yeah, that sounds very beautiful to me. Maybe it needs to move into marriage, and maybe it doesn't. I don't really know. But let me just give you my brief definition of love, okay? And then you can apply this to your situation as you see fit. As I would say that to love someone is to want and to do the good for them. Okay, to will and to do the good of the other. That's what love is. Now, what that requires is that you think about what's actually good for them, which is different than what's convenient for you, and it's also different than what's convenient for them. I mean, a lot of times people want things that aren't good for them, and so it requires quite a bit of discernment to really do that, to follow through with that. But that's what I would say is love, is to will and to do the good of the other person. And so the relationship that you have here, that what you're describing to us, could very well be a very loving relationship in its way. And, you know, it sounds like from adding up the numbers here, it sounds like you're at the time of your life when that might be, you know, really a very appropriate situation for you is to remain unmarried and in a good solid friendship.
can I ask you, on the flip side of that, as far as, you know, I come from a very dysfunctional family, and I've had to iron through a lot of things. I've been through a lot of Christian counseling and things like that, and divorce recovery and so forth. And the type of background that I've come from a very line of negative and very critical. And I've had to work through of being in a relationship, not being critical. And I think for some reason, men have the tendency to you know, weigh in that critical zone. And, you know, things, let me be more specific, things like that might bother you, or expectations that are not being met, some little fears that you might have about this person when you finally do make a commitment, that might, something might come up that you didn't anticipate. Just things like, you know what I'm saying?
So, John, are you saying that you think that men are more inclined to be negative going into a marriage relationship? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and I guess I just don't know how to handle the, you know, the love relationship. What you're saying, what I've been reading, is a love, a commitment, and a decision that you make. And that's accepting that person.
Ooh, I think we just lost
it is accepting the person. If I think I know where he was going with that. It does mean accepting the person as they are in a certain way. And one of the things I talk about in the booklet is that you have no right to expect your partner to satisfy all of your desires. And I think this is a big mistake that we get into. So that if your partner isn't doing things the way you want them to do, or doing things the way you think they ought to be doing, that doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong with you or with them. It doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong. It means that you're two different, distinct people. And, you know, if you're really secure in yourself, and you really have a good sense of yourself and have a good, strong ego sense, you might say, you don't need to have your own way all the time. And this is something that we get confused about. You know, we think that having good self-esteem means that you're asserting yourself all the time. And I really don't think that's true. I think that if you need to win on an unimportant quarrel, that is not a sign of strength. That's a sign of weakness. That's a sign that you have to have your own way all the time, and that you're kind of a big baby, you know, and that if you were a little more grown up and a little tougher, you know, you could just kind of roll with it. Okay, she likes pink, I like blue, well, the heck with it, you know, let her have the pink, you know, and to just kind of relax about some of those things so that you're not fussing at one another about things which are ultimately not all that important. And as you spend more time with a person and become more deeply committed to the person, a whole different, it just kind of changes your perspective about what's really important and what's really not important. And you learn to give way on things that don't matter very much. And you just find out that you're not going to die if you don't get what you want for dinner. And, I think we have a lot of confusion about self-assertion versus self-esteem on this point.
John, call back, I'll send you, this booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Everyone else who calls during the remainder of this hour will receive this booklet by our guest, Jennifer Roback Morse, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And, of course, we're not only here to give advice, but also maybe our listeners have advice to give the rest of us on marriage as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of the things that I have found very important, Jennifer, is to draw a bold line between courting and marriage. I've had women write me and say, look, this guy, I love him, but I can't get, he isn't ready to make a commitment, as though he needs to make a commitment before they get married. And I've sometimes written back saying, the commitment will come when he says, I want you to be my wife. That's where the commitment comes. But don't expect that from a boyfriend. Don't expect it from someone you're just dating. There's a difference between those two. Have we kind of tried to front load all of the commitment? Then when we get to marriage, it seems as though we're left with just, okay, now what are we going to do?
Well, I think...
We front load the sex, we front load everything else.
Yeah, yes, I see your point. I think that one of the things that we do is that by moving into a sexual part of the relationship way too early, it's very difficult to make a sensible kind of commitment, you know, and to really understand, is this a person that I can live with for a lifetime? When you say, you know, and I'm not quite sure what these callers or writers are saying to you, Todd, are they saying that... the fellas don't want to make a commitment, or they don't understand what's involved in a commitment.
They don't want to. They understand what it is. They just...
Yeah, they don't want to. And, I hear that all the time, too. I think it's fairly typical that men are resistant to making a commitment. And it might be that one reason why is that once men get married, they're much less likely to sue for divorce than are women. Most people don't realize this, but somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of divorces are initiated by women. So that once a couple gets married, it's the guy who's holding on to the relationship quite often. And so maybe there's a certain, a kind of sense to the fact that the fellows are more resistant. But I do think that some of the fears that people have are based on just sort of a general fear of relationship that people have developed in this culture.
You have also written about marriage as not a system of labor, but a place where labor issues do come in. I was talking with my daughter last night. She was doing her homework. I was doing the dishes. She was saying, I don't want to do this. She was doing it, but I don't want to do this. And in my fatherly way, I said, honey, adult life is made up of a lot of things that you don't want to do. Most of what I do in the day, I don't want to do. I do that because I need to do it. Do you think I want to be doing the dishes? No. How do the husband and wife sort out that division of labor when the details of marriage are messy? There's a lot of stuff that needs to be done that nobody wants to do.
Well, ain't that the truth? There are a lot of things that people don't want to do. One of the more destructive things that people have tried to do is to say that we're entitled to have exact equality of household chores right down the middle, and that I, as a woman, am affronted if my husband doesn't do half or his share of every single thing that I happen to think is important to get done. On the other hand, I don't think about the fact that he has his own list of things that need to get done, and so he would like to see me do half of some of those kinds of chores. And so what I propose is that people give up on the idea of equal division of household chores. That equal division thing, I actually think that's a bust. I think that's been a real blind alley for couples to go down, because you can be continually bickering over who did what, and, you know, did I do my share and you didn't do your share, and so on and so forth. I think a much more realistic thing to do is for each person, you know, particularly if we're saying, what can I do individually to take care of my marriage, to improve my marriage, is to say, what is it that I think really is the most important thing to get done? Knowing that I can't necessarily count on everybody else in the household to agree with me about what needs to get done, and then I just take responsibility for taking care of what needs to get done. That, again, helps you to sort out what's really important. It helps to let the important things rise to the top and a lot of other stuff just sift down to the bottom. And you quit fussing over details that aren't important enough to you. If it's not important enough to you to do in the first place, then why is it important enough to you to nag your husband about? And that's the way I look at it. So I think that kind of perspective is much more helpful than demanding equal division. The other thing I say in the booklet is that rather than aiming for a 50-50 marriage, it makes much more sense to aim for a 100-100 marriage, what I call a 100-100 marriage. I do all I can for you, and you do all you can for me, knowing perfectly well that there are times and situations where all you can do is not very much because you're stressed out or you're sick or whatever. And same with me, that there are going to be moments when I'm going to be hysterical over something and I'm going to be causing problems rather than solving problems. And that's just part of the ebb and flow of living with another flawed, sinful human being in the house. I mean, you know, Todd, we've talked about this before. The whole problem's original sin. You know, if we could just get rid of that, then everybody could have a happy marriage. But since we can't, this is what we have to do to try to manage the ill effects.
We're talking about marriage with Jennifer Roback Morse. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She's author of the book, Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. And she's written this new booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier marriage. She also has a website, jointhemarriagerevolution.com. Now, that's a lot of letters. They're all run together. jointhemarriagerevolution.com or call in numbers 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Sally's up next, calling from her car. Sally, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. My question, I don't know if you've answered, I just came in on part of this. It's been really good, by the way. I guess her pamphlet would be good for, like, you know, when you've been married 13 or 10 or 15 years and things, you just seem like you're in a rut. You know, it's not the same as when you first got married and everything's new and interesting. And the second part would be, having been divorced, it's like, how do you help your children? You know, I'm not a good example for them for how to do a marriage. And I'll hang up to listen.
Sally, two good questions. First of all, she asks about a marriage that's kind of in a rut. Now, I'll say this at the outset. I love the rut. I'm a man. Men love the rut. Women can't stand the rut. Men are like, now this is comfortable. Now this is nice. Her advice, and then about not being the best example if you come from multiple marriages.
Well, let me deal with that rut question, because Todd, that's so wonderful that you admitted that you enjoy the rut. That's just fabulous, because that illustrates one of the really important facts about married life, which is that men and women are different. Okay, I know it's not politically correct to say that, but get over it, folks. Grow up. Men and women are different. This is a scientifically proven fact. And one of the good things about men and women being different is that we tend to moderate each other's excesses. So if one person has a desire for a lot of adventure and excitement, which in our family would be my husband, he wants, you know, to go sailing and hang gliding and all these other things, and I would just soon read a book, he keeps me from being a couch potato. On the other hand, if your idea of excitement is really intimate, personal, romantic kind of conversation, you know, fellas, your wife's trying to tell you something, you know, you can move along in her direction a little bit too. And so to realize that each person, from our very differences, we're bringing something of value to the other that we really couldn't create for ourselves. When you realize that about the other person, you can appreciate it. Now, Sally, what I want to say to you about that, though, is you're looking for some excitement, I sense, in your marriage. And what I think is helpful is to redefine what you mean by excitement. So for me, and this is going to sound funny, but you see, keeping your marriage together is in fact an adventure. And if you see it as an adventure, then you can realize that holding your tongue is a kind of, there's a kind of excitement to that. There's a kind of excitement to knowing that you're doing the right thing, even though it's difficult. And your husband doesn't have to know you're doing this, okay? You don't have to get him to pat you on the back and saying, oh, you're being such a wonderful wife because you're not pestering me. No, you know that you're doing that, and you can gratify yourself a little bit with that by knowing that you're doing the right thing. And take some satisfaction from the adventure of lifelong love, that when you're not nagging him, even though you feel like it, when you're resisting that temptation, you're doing something important and noble, and you can enjoy some romance about that, even if it's only in your mind. And I find that to be very helpful. Now, the other point that you raise about being a good example for your kids, that's a wonderful question, and I really applaud you for asking that question, because not everybody has the guts to bring that up, and I really respect you for that. The first thing that I would say to you is, do not badmouth your ex-spouse. Above all, just, if you can't find anything nice to say about him, don't say anything, you know. But I think it's hard to think of a case where it's really okay to say something bad about the person you're married to or the person you used to be married to, especially if you have children in common with the person that you used to be married to. It's very important that you not say anything negative about their father. So that would be the very first thing that I would say about it. And there's much else, of course, that we could say on that subject. But I just want to say I really applaud you for even bringing it up.
There is a picture, and it has emerged so quickly. What was it? 3-4 years ago, there was this garish show, Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire? And people who thought it was funny thought it was sad. And they thought, what is becoming of the world? Now, it's the fare of television. Now, we have Who Wants to Marry My Dad? And people are sitting at home ooing and awing as three daughters decide which of these nameless contestants are going to marry their handsome father, and we think it's the height of romance. We think this is, boy, I wish I could have my spouse chosen this way by an impartial jury of my daughters or something like that. What has become of marriage, and how do we take what something that has become so severely derailed, put it back on the track for what it ought to be, for the sake of ourselves, our kids, and society?
Well, good question, Todd, and I think each one of us has to take responsibility for turning off the TV when a program like that comes on. You know, these programs wouldn't be on if people didn't watch them. So, you know, you just need to turn that stuff off, to be quite honest with you, and not celebrate it in any way. And that you can badmouth, folks. You have my permission to badmouth those kind of tacky programs, because they really are tacky. And besides that, I mean, think about it. Having your teenage daughters pick out your spouse, what the heck do your teenage daughters know about anything? You know, that's mad from the start. So, yes, we really have gone off the rails, and that really does illustrate the consumer mentality about marriage and human sexuality at work. And it's gross. Nobody wants to be on the receiving end of that. I'll repeat that, you know. I mean, I'm sure these people are getting paid to be the contestant on there, but gee whiz, that is demeaning, you know, and we really shouldn't put up with that for ourselves.
Tomorrow you're going to be back with us here in Studio A, as long as you're here in St. Louis, but tomorrow you'll be back to talk to us and our audience as well. What will we be discussing tomorrow about women being informed?
Well, tomorrow I really wanted to chat with your listeners, if I could, Todd. I really appreciate you letting us do this. I have noticed that many new mothers who are well-educated women just have a heck of a time reading good books and finding time to keep themselves informed. So I wanted to talk to your listeners about what kinds of formats for information work for them. Would they rather listen to a CD? Would they rather read a small pamphlet like the one I've just written? Or would they like to read a full-fledged book? And what kinds of things work out best? So I'd really like to talk to your listeners about it. I have some things to give away. In addition to the pamphlet, I have a CD to give away. It's called Myths of the Sexual Revolution, Why Recreational Sex is No Fun. And if that topic doesn't get people to call in, I don't know what will. So I really would like to engage the mothers, particularly in our audience, about what the rhythm of your daily life is like, such that you could become better informed. What could I, as an information provider, do to make it easier for you to get the kind of content that you need in a form that you can use it?
Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. You can purchase this book and her new booklet, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage, by calling Spence Publishing toll-free, 1-888-SPEN-PUB, 1-888-SPENPUB, or you can find out more about 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage on the web at www.spencepublishing.com. Don't forget Jennifer's website as well, jointhemarriagerevolution.com. Jennifer, thank you for being our guest. Look forward to tomorrow's conversation.
Thank you, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to be turning our attention to, well, sending your kids off to school. Not only sending your kids off to school, but even if you only drive them to the bus stop or walk them down to the bus stop for school, a family's life changes when the school year begins, and we'll get some advice for the new school year from Lynn Fredrickson, headmaster at Messiah Lutheran School in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and a board member for the youth organization called Higher Things. That's coming up after the break. Feel free to join us during that hour and the remainder of the program at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll also be talking about St. Nathaniel, also called Bartholomew, with Pastor Burnell Eckert. And we'll hear some audio later in the program from the famous atheist Michael Newdow. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.